Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WAPC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
But this ain't no rag. It's a flag, old glory, red, white, and blue. The stars and the stripes, when it comes to a fight, we can do what we have to.
7 minutes after the hour of 5. I hate, I despise country western. Charlie Daniels, the whole cabal. Leave that to Nash. Not WABC. Enough of that. Although I just want to comment very briefly on Bill Evans, our meteorologist, talking about the rain outside. We desperately need that. The reservoirs are parched in Jersey, Rockland County, and some of the tri-state area locations where we gather water up. We need it desperately. So rain is good. And we need a hell of a lot more of it. And remember the story we did just last week. The schmucks, the putzes, who run the water supply for northern New Jersey, the Suez Company, was ready to sell 5 million gallons of preciously needed New Jersey water a day to Rockland County. What a bunch of jadrules. Number two, to all of you New York Met fans, and I was so insulting of all of you last night at the New York Yankee Steakhouse on West 51st Street for Sid on sports and stuff. Great crowd. It was packed. A lot of sports guys from WFAN who have made the transition to WABC to listen to Bernard McGurk and Sid Rosenberg, and obviously on Imus in the Morning. Great, great show up. But to hear that cesspool, the Cuban, has now been signed up for 4 years by the Wilponzi's, scam masters extraordinaire with Madoff dollars, has made my stomach turn. And then lastly, oh yeah, I was just listening to Michael Savage, and I will be the first to acknowledge that we as talk show hosts are half mashug, half ubats, crazy in many instances, and we think the world revolves around us. But Michael Savage went on to say something earlier today that's just not true. Like a lot of what we say in talk radio.
They make believe I don't exist. I elected Trump. I elected Trump. I'm going to be the harshest reality
enough of that.
Deal maker on this planet.
Let me tell you, if we were so powerful in talk radio, Barack Obama would never have been president for two terms. Every radio talk show host on the right was aligned in opposition to Barack Obama, and he beat back the horde twice, first against McCain, then against Romney. The only time in my memory a radio talk show host has ever impacted on any election, it had to do with local, statewide elections, never a national election, was the great king of talk radio, Bob Grant, my mentor. When he campaigned for Christine Todd Whitless to become governor and turn Jersey Florio free in 93, Governor Florio had raised the taxes. He was ahead in the polls. And Bob Grant single-handedly went out on tour, a bus tour with Christine Todd Whitless, and had her on the radio constantly, although she didn't deserve it. She was a traditor, a backstabber, a Judas to him. And then to Mario Faccia Brutta Como. He campaigned against Mario with the famous statement, Mario, ascendeme, tu sei un provio sfacim. And he was. And he lost to the person that nobody knew, George Pataki. Other than that, we have played no role in electing or unelecting a president of the United States in talk radio. But on the line, a guy who certainly played a very important role from almost day one of the Trump campaign is Al Baldassaro. He's a New Hampshire state representative. You saw him wear that red hat earlier, Make America Great Again, a veteran, Marine, and a Donald Trump supporter through and through. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5 again, Al.
Well, thanks, Curtis. It's always an honor to be on Simplify.
Now, got to ask you a question. Donald Trump, throughout the campaign, and you were with him often for 18 months, never once mentioned the burning of an American flag and as to whether there should be some kind of penalty. In fact, I remember they were burning flags outside of the RNC convention that nominated Donald, and he didn't even say anything then, nor did any of the surrogates. But yesterday he tweeted out that he felt if you burnt an American flag, you should lose your citizenship and do a year in jail. And as a veteran, I wanted to see if that floated your boat, Al.
Well, you know, I mean, it kind of motivated me on what he said, but reality, I know it couldn't happen because of the Supreme Court decisions over the years under freedom of speech. But what I'd like to add there is that everyone that burns a flag, if they don't have a burn permit, they should be fined. Then they should be fined for litter on the ground of the flag burning. This way it will slow down this flag burning because of my fellow veterans that gave their life fighting for that flag.
No doubt about it. And I've heard veteran after veteran say, look, I disagree with the desecration of the American flag in whatever method it takes, whether you shred it, you burn it, you soil it, you stain it, you throw paint on it, turn it upside down, or whatever you do. But you shouldn't end up going to jail or lose your citizenship over it, because many of the men who fought and died and were injured said that was one of the reasons that they fought for a person's right to make those kind of choices.
Well, you know, Curtis, I honestly believe Donald Trump is a true patriot who believes in America first. And it disgusts him just like it does a lot of us. But he's not a politician, okay? And I'm sure he's not familiar with all the Supreme Court decisions throughout the years. I happen to sit on State and Federal Relations Veterans Affairs Committee for the last 10 years dealing with constitutional issues. So I knew right off the bat, if you read my tweet, I corrected that and said that they should be fined for litter.
Yes.
And no burn permit.
Now, am I correct? Because I know the president-elect Donald Trump, oftentimes, whatever came across his desk or he was privy to in conversation, he sometimes fixates on it and then naturally will tweet about it. But up near your neck of the woods, I don't know how close it is to you in New Hampshire, but Hampshire College, which is not in New Hampshire, it's in Western Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, liberal town.
Right, but apparently there was the thought that some of the students in the aftermath of Trump's unexpected victory burnt some American flags. And as a result, the administration at Hampshire College decided to temporarily stop flying the U.S. flag until they fully vetted this out. Do you think that played any role in Trump suddenly deciding to tweet about that?
I think it, I mean, taking a guess, I don't speak for Trump, but I think it probably played a big role because the college was wrong on taking that flag down. That's a disgrace. That's a typical progressive school that is the next closest thing to socialism, and it's a disgrace. So I think Donald Trump probably, you know, not understanding and not being involved in a lot of this stuff, is, you know, speaking out against it. And I respect it, but I know the law, and I know the Supreme Court decision. So, you know, it's a form of freedom of speech. It's a disgrace.
Well, for instance, I noticed, Al, that a lot of people who are very patriotic, they have the best interests at heart in flying the American flag, don't necessarily know the rules and regulations that should be addressed accordingly with the proper presentation of a U.S. flag. You don't fly it at night in the dark. You have to shine a light on it. There's a certain way you hang it. I remember we used to learn that in civics class. It used to be part of civics once a week in public school. We no longer have a civics class. So whether you're a flag burner or you're a flag promoter, I think most Americans really don't know the decorum surrounding the proper showing of an American flag and also the proper disposal of an American flag.
No, Curtis, if people did a Google search and they looked up U.S. flag code, read sections 1 through 10 in the U.S. flag code. It talks about half-mast flag, what the procedures are. And if you look under President Clinton when he was in there, he signed an executive order giving governors the authority to drop the American flag to half-mast. Now they drop it down for Whitney Houston or superstars in Hollywood. It's a disgrace on what they've done under Clinton throughout the years now, the governors.
Well, do appreciate that, Al Baldessaro, New Hampshire State Representative, tried and true Donald Trump supporter, U.S. Marine, and a guy who looks at it a little differently than the Donald does when it comes to burning flags. By the way, I could have swore that the flag was half-staffed at City Hall by Comrade Bill de Blasio, who spent his honeymoon with his wife in Havana in the glory days of Fidel and Raul Castro behind the sugarcane curtain of Fidel and Raul Castro. We'll get into that up next.
Curtis Sliwa, The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
This is incredible, ladies and gentlemen. On Saturday, the bearded one, Fidel Castro, was cremated. Normally, if you're cremated, that's it, right? With Castro, he got cremated twice. His ashes first, and then he went straight to hell without an asbestos suit, and no doubt got cremated in that hot, hot place that we've all been told to avoid. But I could have swore, as his entourage makes the last trip around the island of Cuba from Havana to Santiago, that in line would be Congressman Charlie Rangel, big supporter of Fidel Castro over the years, would be Congressman Jose Serrano, would be the owner of Jimmy's Cafe, who hosted him on one of his, I think, four visits to New York City. And in fact, would include Sean Penn, a whole host of other Hollywood trendoids, freakazoids, jet setters, and definitely at the head of that parade would be Hurston Barrero, political commentator at New York One, my partner on Wednesday nights that you can see both at 7 and 11, and editor-at-large for City and State New York. We are talking to you in Cuba, aren't we, Hurston?
I wish I was in Cuba, but I'm not. How's that? Are you okay with that, or do you want me? I'm actually leaving after tomorrow's show so that I can actually participate in the day, 9 days of mourning where festivities and any liquor is not being sold. They respect their leaders. And by the way, Curtis, I remind you, the first revolutionary that the world has known, his name is Jesus Christ. The good Lord was a revolutionary. Do you recall that? He's not in hell. Neither is Fidel going to hell, despite of the fact that you and some crazy Cubans in Miami, in that bubble they live in, they think that he's such an evil man. Remember, the first revolutionary didn't belong to a party, but he did throw things over, didn't he?
Hurston, right. Let us not forget my amigos, my brothers in the struggle against Fidel and Raul, the great Cuban Americans along Bergen Line Avenue in Hudson County in New Jersey, who were also celebrating like it was 1999.
Well, how Christian is that, to celebrate the death of an enemy? That's not Christian, very humane-like, but that's the way they chose to be. They quote, you know, these are the people that you go to the bubble in Miami or Hudson County and you speak. If you decide to, as you say, a few good things about Fidel, they want to kill you. So they talk about a tyrant, a dictator. What do you think they're doing in these United States, particularly the United States? I also want to remind you, as you try to make Fidel to be out, look, there's no denying he wasn't perfect, just like none of the 44 presidents we've had in the United States have been perfect. But remember, he came after the revolution. He came to the UN. He came to the United States. And the United States, you seem to conveniently forget, as you're maligning his memory, that he came for help. And then what could he do? There were two superpowers, so he turned to the USSR, the Soviet bloc. What could he do? He needed to feed his people. The United States turned him down because they couldn't control him. Their puppet, Fulgencio Batista, ran like a little puppy afraid of Fidel when he came in with his revolutionaries. And people forget that context. You just can't Google stuff. You have to be able to live it. I know you know the story. You just want to tell your version of vilifying Fidel Castro.
Excuse me, Hurston Barrero. Why is it that Fidel Castro, Raul Castro supporters consistently vilify, for instance, U.S. Senator Bobby Menendez in New Jersey, Ted Cruz, and little Marco Rubio as gusanos, as worms, because they are anti-Castro?
Well, I would say that you have to go back to Cuba, and the reason that they did that, and I'm not justifying any name calling. The fact is that there are reasons. And by the way, all of those that you mentioned, light-skinned Cubans that are now here living in the United States in the comfort, as a matter of fact, they should thank Fidel Castro because they found a new life in another part of the world. They should be thanking and praying and thanking the good Lord for having produced Fidel Castro, because otherwise they would have lived in Cuba and not come out or even known that Bob Menendez wouldn't sit the Senate. He wouldn't have been, and neither Marco Rubio. And by the way, you notice that the lines, I know you've seen the footage, you notice that they aren't all white. There are black Cubans, people from descendants of Africans. You understand that, right? That is also a thing of how blacks were excluded in the Fulgencio Batista years, in the kind of Cuba that you wanted, along with all those gangsters that went and built casinos and created prostitution rings. None of that exists in Cuba. I'm not saying Fidel was perfect, but Fidel did have a purpose as a revolutionary. So you got to understand, some people here in Miami, in the bubble they live in Hudson County, they may not respect him or have honored him, but there are other people throughout the world that actually do.
Final question, though, Hurston. Speaking of black Cubans, just as old as Castro, although he's still alive somewhere, I think in New Jersey he lives now, El Duque. You remember El Duque? We didn't quite know how old he was, but I think he's approaching 90. And then I just heard, shockingly, that the number one black Cuban playing American baseball now has been re-signed by the Wilpanzis with Madoff money, Cespedes Cespedes, for like $125 million over 4 years. Isn't it great to be a black, a Cuban who escaped Castro and now can play a boys game for $125 million Wilpanzi Madoff dollars?
God bless America. This is what the USA is all about, and he's a black Cuban, really good for the Mets. You know I'm not a Mets fan like you. I'm a Yankee fan. That we share. So is Fidel Castro. He was a Fidel Castro was a Yankee
fan?
Yes,
he was.
Shared that with us. So all I'm saying is congratulations to the Mets fans. Cespedes is a great player. 4 years, at least they have a shot, because this guy knows how to bat. He knows how to place the bat and place the ball. So that, congratulations to the Mets. If they can get rid of the Wilpons, maybe they could have a team, a real Major League Baseball team.
You know something, Hirschen Barrero? Cespedes, a.k.a. Cespool, is just as whacked out as you. You talk about eccentric? That's Cespedes.
Curtis Lewa.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
Oh, my God. What a degenerate hip-hop monstrous. Krishan, you really? We have to go that route to talk about knockoffs? Might as well play Nicki Minaj a trois and cause me to want to impale myself with this microphone. But it was chosen by our producer, Justin B. Love, or whatever, who decided that it's the perfect entree to discuss a headline story that the king of all merchandisers, online merchandisers, Amazon, has finally acknowledged that it has a serious problem. When you put in an order, in some instances, the products that they're selling to you are knockoffs of fake goods. And they promise they're going to crack down on this. On the line to discuss it is Ming Wei, Chief Strategy Officer, partner, and co-founder of FakeSpot.com. Thanks for joining us on the Drive Home at 5, Ming Wei.
Thank you for having me.
First off, what is FakeSpot.com?
FakeSpot.com is an review authentication website. You plug in your products from Amazon, for example, and we will give you a grade to tell you whether the reviews are real or fake.
Wow. So you can do that based on a review. You don't have to smell the product, touch it, feel it, or open it up and look at the stitching and the seams to see if it's the real deal?
No, all we do is we will look at every review of the product, and then we look at every reviewer who left a review and their product review history. And based on the patterns of how they review the products, we can tell whether it's real or fake.
Ah. Now, Ming Wei, years ago, I had visited Manila in the Philippines, starting a Guardian Angel chapter, and there was a four-square block area that was referred to as Knockoff City. I was amazed. We were in the midst of a monsoon. It was raining cats and dogs. And as I walked under what was like this huge Quonset hut, there were products there. Every conceivable product that we would purchase, let's say in a department store online in America, was knocked off there. Didn't the retailers and wholesalers see this coming?
I think Amazon, if you're talking about Amazon specifically, I don't think they saw it coming. They needed more products in their pipeline. And I don't think they ever thought that this would ever happen the way that it's turned out.
So what can be done to crack down on this, since I would suggest that from what I've seen from street sales, even down here, 23rd and Broadway in Manhattan, they call it Little Nairobi, Nigeria, because of all the street sales of knockoffs, and even into now mainstream department stores, there's such an epidemic. What can be done to cut back on it?
I think the consumer has to be a little bit more educated. Having tools like FakeSpot is one thing, but more often than not, you know the saying goes, if it's too good to be true, generally something's wrong there.
But isn't it true, though, that the quality of the knockoff products have improved measurably?
The quality of knockoffs, I think, overall, yes, they're just as good. But you're looking at now, people think of knockoffs as like designer labels and designer bags. But Amazon, to this point now, they're even knocking off basic things that you and I would never think, oh, this is a $10 item. Why would somebody knock it off? But, you know, if you have a mom-and-pop shop or company that's based in, let's say, the Midwest, and they're selling something very simple and something basic that they patented themselves and they had made, but they're selling maybe a million units of a $10 item, somebody's going to knock them off. And so it's not just designer handbags. You're talking about small businesses in America that are now getting hurt by these counterfeits.
So now here's this multinational company, Amazon. So Jeff Bezos, founder, creator, billionaire now, owns the Washington Post, other entities as a result of the wealth acquired through Amazon. He knew he was selling knockoffs. So is there any agency in the federal government you can go to as a consumer or whatever and say, hey, I've been ripped off, and this guy knew all about it?
It's I'm not sure that even if you complain, let's say, to the Federal Trade Commission, that it makes any sense. It will do you any good, because even if Amazon closes one account, one seller, that same seller that operates in a different country out of the jurisdiction of Amazon will just open another account and they can sell the product. And Amazon has so many accounts and so many products.
Yeah, but
you literally have to have a police.
Right. But other than Amazon, right, Amazon facilitates the delivery of the product. But I always thought before that it was actually the manufacturers who would have to take money out of their pocket and hunt down the phonies. Now I would think the very people that profit from selling it to you should be forced to do likewise.
I think everybody has kind of have to work together on this problem and not just pass the buck onto the consumer.
Well, do appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an absolute epidemic out there. And I know, as Ming Wei said, Chief Strategy Officer for FakeSpot.com, that some of you don't care because it looks like the real deal. The stitching is the same. You look inside, you look outside, you smell it, sniff it, touch it, scratch it. It appears to be a Gucci. It appears to be a Versace. You don't care. But in reality, isn't that stealing? Isn't that cheating? Maybe we should apply the old Spike Lee attitude towards those who would knock off albums, right? And knock off CDs. Maybe you have to take a little vigilante action and stand on a corner with a baseball bat in your hand and kneecap those that are profiting illicitly.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Guardian Angel founder Curtis Sliwa.
WABCRadio.com.
Pond 54, back to back, belly to belly. If you remember last week, we spoke with the new head of the Correctional Department's Union, who was taking on the city because here are all these correctional officers who are getting abused by inmates. And there's no more Bing. There's no more solitary confinement. There's no other way of disciplining them other than if you take the tactical patrol force and you have them come charging in and just beat the living daylights out of them, which then leads to other problems for the correctional officers because then they're accused of being abusive, which in that case they would be. But you take away the Bing, you take away solitary confinement, bad. And what would Comrade Bill de Blasio know? He never's been locked up. Pre-Pahara, U.S. Attorney of the Southern District, who said they have to close Rikers Island. What would he know? He's never been locked up. They're used to locking people up, Pre-Pahara, in the U.S. Attorney's office. And now is a bit of news that I thought we'd all be praising. We'd be jumping up and down. Corey Haliosky, hallelujah. A report by the Mameluke, the Mashad, the city controller of New York, Scott Stringer's office, that the number of inmates on Rikers Island has reached its lowest point in 3 decades. And that's absolutely incredible. Let's give him a round of applause for that, right? There's a lot of guys who are not mutts and skells. They're simply on Rikers Island, gals too, because they can't make the bail for a crime of almost no consequence. And so we're keeping them there for 4, 5, sometimes 6 months, and no reason. Now, others, for sure, you got to keep them there. But I would have thought that this was a cause for celebration until you read the small print that talks about as the population declined to a 33-year low of 9,700 from, Oh, I remember way back in the crime epidemics of the Koch years and the Dinkins years. Not only was there overpopulation, they had about 18,000 inmates. Rikers and all of its units were overpopulated. You had the Tombs downtown, which was called the Bernie Kerik Correctional Center. Huh, he should have done time there. Then you had at the time the Bronx House of Detention that was open, Queens House of Detention, Brooklyn House of Detention. And they purchased two of the barges that were used in the Argentine campaign by Maggie Thatcher when she went to retrieve the Falkland Islands from the Argentines. And we converted them into floating prisons. Don't need any of that anymore. And yet it now costs more money than before to house a Rikers Island inmate. From about $90,000 a year to $132,000 a year. In fact, the ratio now of inmates to correctional officers is 1-on-1. And if you've ever been on Rikers Island like I've been, and the CEOs, they're always eating breakfast. You know, they're having second, thirds, they're eating that lousy breakfast there. But a lot of the inmates are stored in dormitories. So there's 40 guys in a room, generally with a... I'd say a 4'8" African-American female correctional officer who only has a body alarm on, and that's the only thing that keeps them in line. So if there's a one-to-one ratio, what are all the other CEOs doing? Why is it costing more money now? And what the hell is the Commissioner of Corrections, Joseph Ponte, doing? A guy whose claim to fame was he ran the correctional system in Maine where they were arresting people who were shooting caribou and moose? Huh?